KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
The Mission. Excelsior.
Redwood City.
American Canyon.
San Francisco.
Vallejo.
I'm from Redwood City, so I guess that's in the peninsula.
Coming up, an explosion of flowers. We're digging into the recent superbloom craze.
Is superbloom a scientific term?
Absolutely not.
Then a replica of the city of San Francisco.
Every building in the city had been depicted on this model in three-dimensional, but it was difficult to see a lot of it because it had 60 to 80 years of dust.
And we say goodbye to a Mission icon after 90 years.
I'm gonna miss this place. I'm gonna stock up. I'm gonna probably be back for more. Whatever my freezer will hold.
Luca Ravioli and more coming up on Cross Currents. Well, spring has sprung, and after a very wet winter, California is now awash with flowers, and thousands of people are going to see them.
Crowds have been flocking to Southern California to see the super bloom of poppies in their rush to take those selfies. They're trampling the flowers.
Lake Elsinore says it's overwhelmed by the so-called a populace.
The concern grew so big that over the weekend, they actually shut down the area, saying the situation has escalated beyond our available resources.
KALW science reporter Marissa Ortega Welch had a few theories about the origins of this super bloom mania and its impact.
Look, I'm from San Diego, and I grew up going to the desert, but I had never heard this term super bloom until a couple years ago. And suddenly it feels like everybody's talking about it. My friends in the Bay and friends of friends, parents of friends, people that I didn't even know were into nature are all taking long road trips to places like Walker Canyon and the Carrizo Plain to see wildflowers. Because I'm a Grinch, I was skeptical of all this hype. And I had some questions. The first being, where did this term super bloom come from?
Continue on I-5 south for 186 miles.
So I decided to get in my car and drive to find some answers. All the way to the visitor center at Anza Borrego State Park in the Southern California desert. Five rangers field tourist questions and hand out maps.
If you are here just for flower information, please meet me out on the patio at the big map. I'm going to
Do you remember the first time you heard the term superbloom?
No, I think a few years ago, I think it was the first time I heard of a superbloom. Yeah.
1980s. I remember seeing it on TV and, you know, on the radio and all that also.
From her, like last week. She's like, yeah, there's a superbloom. I'm like, oh, okay, let's check it out. Here's Ranger Abby Barker.
A superbloom is when the whole desert is in bloom. And every place you look, you see flowers.
But where did the term come from?
I don't know.
I take my question to Dr. Richard Minnick, an ecologist at UC Riverside. I ask him, is superbloom a scientific term?
Absolutely not.
And he doesn't know where it came from either. But Richard says the media's glommed onto it recently as a shorthand for a really good wildflower season.
We never used the word. We looked at it in terms of, is it once a decade, once in a generation, or once in a lifetime?
Okay, so what makes a good wildflower bloom then? Richard says it's a few dry years in a row, followed by a rainy year.
Even if there are no flowers seen in a given year, there's living seed in the ground.
The seeds wait and wait. A seed bank builds up in the ground, holding out for rain. That's what happened during the drought. And something else that keeps native wildflowers from growing, non-native grasses. In wet years, those grasses grow like gangbusters and choke out the wildflowers. But in a really dry year, the grasses die back. And then the next rainy winter...
This is the moment. The flowers will take off because there's no grasses around to interfere with them. And you'll get a great burst of bloom.
That's what people are going out to see right now. But this has happened before, right? Is this excitement about wildflowers new?
It's not novel. As soon as newspapers formed around here, people would talk about the flowers.
Richard wrote a book about the history of wildflower blooms in the state. He says starting in the late 1800s, Southern California papers ran articles about people going to see the wildflowers. He shows me a photo from the 1890s.
Look at the guy in his top hat and suit and tie, and everybody there was picking poppies.
He reads me an article from 1905.
They were gathering the beauties by the handful and the armload. That was March 18th. On March 20th, spare the poppies. If the crowds were people and children who were engaged in pulling up these beautiful flowers, do not show more discretion. The poppies will not be there next year.
So poppy panic, even back then. Okay, the excitement is nothing new. But then why do I feel like the recent hype just appeared out of nowhere? In the last decade, we had a string of years with very little rain. Meanwhile, something else was booming.
And now to the hottest apps of the year. iPhone photo program called Instagram. You know the one. It makes it almost impossible to take a bad shot. If you don't know it, check it out.
Today, Facebook announced it has topped 1 billion active users, becoming the first social networking site to hit that number.
Well, 2017 really caught Borrego Springs and the park by surprise.
This is Betsy Kanak, executive director of the Anza-Borrego Desert Natural History Association. When a good wildflower bloom finally hit in 2017, people posted photos of it on social media.
Coming off of those many years of drought, things had changed so much in those years, and whether it was Facebook or Instagram or even the internet, we just did not realize how quickly word spread.
The response was a deluge. Tens of thousands of people flooded into the tiny town of Borrego Springs to see the blooms.
It was very crazy. I'm very glad I was here, or I would not have believed it.
Restaurants ran out of food. Traffic was backed up for an hour getting into the park. Betsy's nonprofit runs a visitor center in town and leads nature programs about the desert. She tells me how people used to hear about a wildflower bloom. Starting in the 70s,
we would ask them to send us a self-addressed stamped postcard.
And the staff there would send them out 2 weeks before a good wildflower bloom was predicted, snail mail style.
I saw one of those postcards some months ago that evidently we had not mailed. Sorry about that, whoever that was. And I looked at that with nostalgia.
Betsy shows me these logs that the staff uses to keep track of visitor numbers over the years.
Oh my goodness, look at the difference in visitation.
Back in 2005, the Nature Center got about 300 people on a good wildflower spring weekend. This year, she says, several thousand people visit the center every day. So I still had one more question. Is the superbloom hype a good thing or a bad thing? This year, Borrego is ready. The whole town had a meeting to prepare. Now, restaurants are staying open, traffic's moving, and a lot of money's coming into the town. Betsy likes that the wildflower blooms bring people to the desert. It helps new people learn about the area. But there are downsides. Flowers get trampled, and there's the carbon footprint of all of us driving here. Could thousands more people visiting a place like Borrego turn into thousands more people invested in protecting it? Or is everyone just here for the Instagram pic? Walking around the desert, I meet people from all over the country. Most people say social media helps them learn when and where to go.
I think I was like on Instagram.
I saw it on Facebook and it attracted me here.
I use like All Trails to find different hikes, and then, you know, I might use Yelp if I want to check out a different area.
But they'd be coming out to nature regardless. Finally, I see some young women posing for a photo on a rock. Okay, here are my Instagram queens, people that are just here to take selfies and post on social media.
What brought you all out here?
Flowers, yeah. It's beautiful, all the butterflies and caterpillars.
This is Sophia Ray, Robin Pearson, Julie Weber, and Jocelyn Ransom. They're on spring break from Cal Poly. Sophia tells me she heard about the superbloom online from seeing other people's photos.
Do you feel like social media brings you out into nature more?
Not necessarily. I mean, we're already nature lovers. Like, yeah, I know all exactly. of us are.
And they're very thoughtful about when they use social media.
Sometimes if you're so focused on taking pictures, then you can't actually enjoy the moment. You know what I mean? Do you feel like that happens to you? Me, at one
well,
point,
they didn't bring their phones out.
I mean,
here,
I didn't
so.
Bring my phone.
Three of them purposefully left their phones in the car. But Robin has her grandfather's old film camera with her.
I saw you all on that rock. That's why I was like, but you were taking a photo with that camera.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Like, you do. Okay, one phone. One phone, yeah. One phone for four people.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you going to post these photos to Instagram?
I don't know, because I don't usually post. Like, the last time I posted was last summer, so so I think it's more of just like a memory that I can keep to myself.
I'm definitely gonna post.
Yeah, same. Like.
I don't know, maybe I'm just in a good mood from all the desert sunshine and flowers, but I feel like the Grinch after Christmas right now. My small heart has grown 3 sizes. As long as visitors know how to minimize their impact and towns are prepared for the onslaught of tourism, maybe having people come experience the beauty of desert wildflowers for themselves isn't such a bad thing. In Anza-Borrego, I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch for Cross Currents.
Marissa is KALW's science reporter. If you've got something you'd like her to dig into, email her at science@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Have you ever wondered what San Francisco looked like 80 years ago? Well, if you go to your local library branch, you can find out. Not from reading a book, but by experiencing an actual architectural model of your neighborhood. It's a new collaboration between SF MoMA and the library, a miniature model of the whole city as it was in 1938. Reporter Nina Sparling checked it out and has this story.
I don't know. Do you see Grove Street? Because I am having a really difficult time. I see DeViz.
Hosanna Rubio is trying to find her childhood home. We're at the Western Edition branch of the San Francisco Public Library, looking down over a map of the neighborhood. She grew up here, so did her parents, so did their parents.
It's really difficult. I'm seeing streets that I associate mostly with Pack Heights, like Sutter, Bush, Pine, California. So I'm having a little bit of a difficult time, personally.
What we're looking at isn't just any old map. It's a piece of a three-dimensional model of the entire city, built in the 1930s. All of San Francisco rendered at scale in miniature. Each building is painted the color it was 80 years ago. Trees are tufts of steel wool painted green. Thin black lines run down Folsom Street in the Mission. Tram tracks long since paved over. UC Berkeley has had this model of the city since the 1960s, but most of it has been in storage in Richmond for years. Dr. Gray Brecken, a professor in the geography department, has been trying to find it a home for the past decade. Then, one day, he got a call from the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. They wanted to know about the model.
We pulled out a few sections of the model, and I was blown away. Every building in the city had been depicted on this model in three-dimensional. But it was difficult to see a lot of it because it had probably 60 to 80 years of dust.
Locals and visitors first saw the model at the 1939 World's Fair on Treasure Island, and not that many people have seen it since.
Today, man reaches new horizons in hours and minutes.
The Works Progress Administration funded its construction as a way to put people to work during the Great Depression. But the sheer size of the map made displaying it a challenge. It's just over 1,500 square feet. That's about the size of a spacious two-bedroom apartment. No institution with a large enough room would give up valuable real estate for the installation. Luckily, the replica is modular. It was constructed in 158 individual but interlocking sections, and each of the 6,000 city blocks can be removed.
I have touched every piece of this. Whoever was working on that quadrant was maybe like a two-martini lunch, you know?
That's Stella Lockman. She works at SF MoMA and manages the project.
And I can tell you that, like, in the Presidio, the roofs are orange, and it has a totally different feeling from the Mission, where a lot of the roofs are brown and white, and has a different feeling from the Tenderloin, where all the roofs are black and brown.
The team came up with a solution to display the massive model. They decided to divide it into sections, and they used branch libraries to exhibit pieces of it all across San Francisco. Now, from the Outer Mission to North Beach, locals can trace the streets with their fingers and identify familiar places. City agencies updated the map here and there over the years, like in the Western Addition, where they added red lines to delineate the city's racist zoning policies of the 1960s. The red lines running down O'Farrell Street stand out to Hosanna Rubio as she tries to find home on the map.
It's actually not even on the map.
No.
So it's, yeah, my house is not on the map, apparently.
That frustrates Hosanna, but she's not that surprised. She's used to the neighborhood not feeling like her own anymore.
I'm a teacher now, and I cannot afford to live in my neighborhood.
Remember, she grew up here. So did her parents. So did their parents.
Yeah, it really speaks volumes on San Francisco and who we really are and who we value.
The exhibits are at the city's public libraries until the end of April. The team at SF MoMA still wants to find somewhere to display the whole model in one piece. But as of now, it hasn't found a home. In San Francisco, I'm Nina Sparling for Cross Currents.
On a warm San Franciscan night, old child, young child, feel all right. On a warm San Franciscan night.
Nina is a student in UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, and a version of that story originally aired on the school station KALX.
Harley Davidson's on a warm San Francisco night. Old angel, young angel, feel all right. On a warm San Francisco night. I wasn't born there. Perhaps I'll die there. There's no place left to go. San Francisco.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The iconic deli and pasta company Luca Ravioli is shutting its doors at the end of the month. A couple of years ago, we reported on it at a time when many of the longtime businesses nearby had been pushed out by new development and surging rents. But this place at 22nd and Valencia Street in the Mission seemed different, more permanent. In its 90-plus years, it had survived many booms and busts. As the neighborhood became less and less recognizable, reporter Beau Walsh wanted to celebrate the enduring slice of classic San Francisco. And in this audiograph, he captured an ordinary day in 2017.
When somebody walks into the store, you know, we have a feeling that there's always something in common with that person. You know, whether it's a love of Italy, it's a love of the food. When somebody walks in, we really feel it's important that they feel like they've stepped out of their daily life and they're sort of in this Italian fantasy.
Good morning, Luca Ravioli. Hey, New York's awesome. Let me take a look. Hold on one sec.
I am Michael Fenno. I am the third generation owner of Luca Ravioli Company. I've been here since 1966. This is my 51st year here. After the 1906 earthquake and fire, this building was rebuilt in 1917, and then the Lavazzoli family put a ravioli company in here. That's the company that my great-grandfather and his wife bought in 1925. The store basically looks the same as it did. We've upgraded, we modernized, we have refrigeration. That's wonderful. My father bought the company. That was in 1967 and ran it through those years. Then in 1987, when my father passed away, I took it over. And so I've owned and run it since then.
What's on special today? I'm cola, $6.90 a pound.
My name is Jim Langell. I started here in 1971. I enjoy working. I enjoy the customers and the old-time San Francisco type of people that we have here.
15. 16. I got 16.
The guy that I replaced was here 33 years. When I first came, there was another guy. He'd already been here 38 years. So a lot of people that come here as workers come and stay here for a long, long time. And, you know, it's all because of Michael's father keeping me here, learning from him, learning from an old-time Italian type of thing.
Thanks again, guys.
Did you ladies need some help, or?
No, I just started to check out.
Okay, let me ring you up for that. Okay.
All those Italian cold cuts, the Calabrese salami, they got a bunch of different stuff here that you just can't find anywhere else.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
Hey, what's going on?
Steve Corbelli, I'm the manager. One of the big things during the holidays is bacalà, which is Italian, it was codfish. Portuguese, Italians, they do a lot of cooking with that. We have a full line of deli meats, different salamis, you know, a lot of charcuterie, which is the word people are using nowadays.
I'm having a sandwich with half a hot capicola and half a hot Calabrese salami and some provolone on a hard sourdough roll.
Can I ask what you guys do in here?
This is just a pasta room, and virtually all our pasta made in this room. The tables and the ravioli filling machine, the dough breaker were all set up after World War II, and they're specifically for our raviolis. We have a ravioli machine over here.
My name is Pedro, and I'm doing this team for around 20 years, and trying to do the best I can.
We've maintained the windows just to show that we're making fresh product by the hour. But over the years, it's been somewhat of an entertainment. And people will come, they'll bring their children, they'll watch the raviolis being made, the dough being thrown, the ravioli machine, filling machine coming down the tracks. And so, it's become more of an entertainment.
I like the people watching me.
That whole thing is little mini raviolis. They're not cut yet.
No, and he's gonna use his machine probably to cut it.
Oh, this one right here.
Yeah.
The quality of the food, outstanding. The ravioli, special. All I can say is overall, it's the best in San Francisco.
When, let's say, a four-year-old child sits down and has a meal of raviolis or tortellini or pasta, and that is the same meal, the exact same recipe that their great-great-grandparents sat down to. You know, we almost feel like we're at these family tables, and it kind of ties everything, the generations together, something that they could share. So we're quite proud of that.
A lot of these people I've known for 47 years. You know, a lot of them today are like, you know, as old as I am, and they started here, coming in here with their parents when they were very little.
Yeah, sometimes I go to the corner, I look up and down the street, and this is San Francisco. And, you know, I know it's changing, but there's some parts of it that aren't changing. Yeah, this is San Francisco, and it's just, you know, for so many generations, so many decades, it's a pleasure being here.
Luca Ravioli will be closing on April 30th, and so Bo wanted to go back just one more time.
It's 2 years later in a very different scene here. There's a long line along the deli case, and it's so crowded that it's hard to maneuver through the narrow aisles. The shelves are a little emptier, and there's a frenetic vibe among the customers, a grabbiness for something that's slipping away.
I always get the turkey meatballs and the meat sauce and the beans, the bean salad. We bought our house on Liberty in 67. So I've been coming since then, and I'm heartbroken. What's to think? I guess they'll put a condo in here and take the parking lot and the whole shebang. But I was hoping somebody would buy it and offer them enough to make it worth their while.
Yeah.
I'm 76.
Oh, he just called you.
As I'm leaving, I see a lady carrying a large cardboard box filled with Luca goodies, and I have to ask what she bought.
Some beef ravioli, then some spinach ravioli, another four, and then their special four. I'm gonna miss this place. I'm gonna stock up. I'm gonna probably be back for more. Whatever my freezer will hold.
Luca Ravioli will close for good on April 30th. Owner Michael Fenno says he's ready to retire, and no one in the family wants to take over. He's already sold the parking lot for $3 million, and there are plans to build a five-story residential building in its place. And the store, well, as of now, it's still for sale. If you want to help keep a part of old San Francisco going, it'll only cost you about $1.5 million. And you never know. Fenno may even throw in the family's ravioli recipe. In the Mission, I'm Beau Walsh for Cross Currents.
Beau is a reporter and producer. You can check out more of his stories at kalw.org. And don't forget to subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to stories from Beau and all our reporters anytime you want. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Kristen McCandless, True Quinn, Porfirio Rangel, Lisa Wang, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.